Oh, damn, I swear this thing was recording. Oh, wait, there it is. Howdy, folks. Double J back here, coming at you live slash recorded from my studio slash spare bedroom, real deep in them foothills of Appalachia, directly from the number one drug overdose death capital of America. That's per capita, of course, folks. Basically, we like to do our drugs here. We do them real good-like, and we die from them. That's the overwhelming trend here in good old Appalachia. Once again, Double J here. I will be your pilot and navigator for this shenanigan-infused journey into the mind of this particular garbage can dude. And on today's Operation GCD adventure, I'm honored to be a guest once again on the Occult Rejects podcast with host Nick, the New York Patriot, and fellow guest, the Headless Giant, as we take a part two to our previous discussion of the Society of Cincinnati 1776 edition, and in today's conversation, the Society of Cincinnati 1812 edition, as in the War of 1812, and how the Society of Cincinnati relates to these seminal events in the history of America, and not only America, but also the history of France. Because the Society of Cincinnati was a joint organization, half French, half American, comprised of the men, initially comprised of only the officers, but later the enlisted, the men who fought in these wars of revolution, both in France and America, but it was a joint effort. Today we discuss some of those elements, not only just the American elements of the society as it relates to the War of 1812, but also the French component as it relates to the War of 1812. Individuals such as Napoleon Bonaparte, who is often described throughout history, many books and whatnot, and current biopic Hollywood films starring Joaquin Phoenix. So obviously a very hot topic of conversation, both culturally and historically speaking, but no one ever mentions that Napoleon was a member of the society and a very important member, as during the French Revolution, there was some back and forth on the pro-liberty elements and the anti-liberty elements. And at one point in time, the ranking and leading generals of the French side were all thrown in prison, including folks like General Lafayette, who was the head of the French side. He was Washington's counterpart on the French side of the society. During these revolutionary times in France, if it wasn't for Napoleon, well, you know, folks like General Lafayette may have died in a French prison. These are the tales that don't always get discussed, but obviously are very relevant. And once again, these are tales where all roads lead back to the Society of the Cincinnati. Anyhow, folks of the interwebs, thanks again for joining us today to get a little GCD. Hope you folks enjoy the conversation between myself, Nick, the New York Patriot, host of the Occult Rejects podcast, and the Headless Giant. Links for myself and both of those gents are in the show notes. And folks of the interwebs, I hope you all enjoy today's conversation, the Society of Cincinnati 1812 edition.
William!
Smoking out the Continental Congress. Everybody's bitches be like all up on us. Patrick Henry's in the corner looking pretty well spent. Ben Franklin got so high he forgot to be president. Your girl just said she never had it hit so good. Smoked so many trees that my fucking teeth turn wood. And if they make a monument to me when I die, it'll be a giant abstract joint up in the sky. But you know they're gonna whitewash me, make up some corny shit about me chopping cherry trees. It's hard to control a people if they're found as a thug, so they'll just teach that I was all prayers, puppies, and hugs. But that just ain't the way it was. We set this whole place up with a hell of a buzz. So next time they try and tell you that this stuff is wrong, look at a dollar, light a blunt, fucking sing my song.
So drugs, run guns, nail sluts, and fuck the law. We're founding fathers, we're Rushmore shit, and we were all high as balls.
Welcome to the Occult Rejects. In this episode, we'll be continuing kind of off of the last episode, as you can see just in the title. It's quite obvious. But we're going to be talking about the War of 1812 and its, I guess, connections to Cincinnati, however you want to call it. And I got back to two people that were on with me originally, obviously. And that is, I got Headless with me again, and I got J.J. Vance. Headless, real quick, let everybody know where they can find your stuff and what your deal is.
Well, you can look at my podcast on Spotify, Headless Giant Podcast, and you can find me on Twitter or X now. And we do spaces every Friday and Sunday. The future is ancient. check it out. We have a lot of interesting topics. So,
very nice. Have you been doing it 2 days for a while? Or is that a new thing?
I've been doing this for about 4 months, 5 months, something like that. No, oh, okay. It's been a while, yeah.
I knew of the Friday, but I didn't know you did Sunday as well. Nice. Very good, man. Very good. And JJ, what is up, my man? You want to let everybody know what your deal is and where they can find you?
Howdy. Howdy, folks. JJ Vance. Nick, I appreciate the invite back. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Always.
Headless, I'm excited. I'm not familiar with this Future is Ancient series you do, so I'm excited to check that out, too. And looking forward to the conversation here on some American history, which is one of my favorite topics that I discuss as the host of the Operation GCD podcast, is specifically within American history, an occult group or a cult-like group known as the Society of Cincinnati, which is obviously a pretense of what much of our discussion is going to revolve around today.
Right.
Looking forward to the conversation.
Started right there, because when it comes to history, there's no more important group in American history than the Society of the Cincinnati. And if you notice, none of the other conspiracy podcasters, none of the other conspiracy groups are even talking about it, because it undermines the whole idea of American supremacy. You know, what they try to do is they try to make a dividing line between American history and this latest iteration of globalism we see today. That line sort of starts around the 1970s, right? But it's not.
Sure.
It's never been that way. It's never been that way. There's never been really a separation between Americanism and the European influence, right?
No, absolutely not. And
what we see with the Society of the Cincinnati is that this influence is directing American history in a way much more powerfully than any other factor in American society. So unfortunately, this isn't taught in American History 101. It's not spoken about on the conspiracy angle. We don't see any of it. Now, two reasons. One, they don't know. Or two, they understand how badly it undermines their position of freedom, liberty, and everything Americana. If it is number two, that means that they're lying to you. If it's number one, you should probably educate them. So this series that we're doing on the Society of the Cincinnati is very, very important for that, because if you don't get to the Society of the Cincinnati, you don't know anything about military history. You don't know anything about how these military events transpired, why we have wars every 10 years. None of that comes into focus. But once you know about the Society of the Cincinnati, you understand that all wars are bankers' wars, and this is how they did it, right? So the Battle of 1812 is definitely one of the most important battles to study when it comes to the Society of the Cincinnati, because this is the first war of aggression, first war of American aggression in their early history. And it was it took place primarily between Michigan and Canada, right? So
along the Canadian border to the New England area, right?
Right. And so what we see happening is that after the Revolution, America has made agreements with France. That this is the entire reason for the Society of the Cincinnati in the first place. They've made agreements with France that they're going to keep the control in the hands of colonial officers. And colonial officers are the only ones allowed to join the Society of the Cincinnati. We've got a guy.
France made that same agreement, though, too, if I may interject. France had the same situation going, because there's the French half of the society. So it's all one kind of collective movement, even though we look at them today, like you pointed out, as America and France, but it's really just the society.
Right. And that was an important thing for France, too, because they are on the cusp of this this revolution getting out of hand, because they had a revolution in France, too. And they thought maybe these societies can manage how things are done better than monarchies. That was the idea both in America and in France. And so they made natural allies at this point.
There was a lot of French dudes that I noticed from going through the list. I didn't use it in the first episode because I just didn't get to it. But there was a lot of them that were Masons before they even came over here. You know, and like it just—it just seemed like to me there was a lot. My opinion, when I was looking at like you know, George Washington being involved with, you know, whatever, but there seems to be a huge like French influence. I think that nobody really noticed. It just seemed weird to me. I was like, why is there so many French people into occultism?
Grand Orient Lodge. What were you saying, Nick? Right. I couldn't hear you there.
It just seems like a lot of French occult people.
Oh, for sure. No, and I think that all that ties into the French and American revolutions through the Grand Orient Lodge with folks like Thomas Jefferson and other, you know, I believe John Jay, some other characters amongst the founding fathers that were all members of that lodge.
There was a lot of people that when I Googled them, you'd even find like history about them on like Freemason pages, but they're not claiming that they're Freemason. You know, like a lodge might have its own like website, and like for some reason they got, you know, the history of this dude, a couple of paragraphs talking about how much of a great man he was. But, you know, we don't know if he was amazing.
Right. Well, I think a lot of times when speaking of American history, everything gets just lumped in as Freemasonry. And I get the impression, I'm not a Freemason, but I get the impression from studying it, it's not that black and white. It's very gray, even internally to some of the actual brands and types of Freemasonry. Again, this Grand Orient one seems to be the kind of the renegade outlaw amongst Freemasonry and very much against the Vatican Church. So that I think that's again part of a long-standing tradition, if you will, amongst these families that are involved in the society, dating back to the, you know, through the revolutionary time of France at the same time as the American Revolution, dating back to their Knights Templar heritage in this ongoing, you know, aristocratic battle, if you will.
Right. There was a decidedly anti-Vatican sentiment in America, too. So, the Vatican actually sent big old blocks to use in the Washington Monument. And what the builders of the Washington Monument did is they smashed them up and threw them in the Potomac River. So they were very decidedly anti-Catholic at that point. Now, you know, again, what changes? You know, what we see is that the Jesuits become far more prominent in America. And Jesuit training becomes the preferred method of education for a lot of the American elites, the East Coast elites. And that shift really took things out of the anti-Catholic mentality and put it towards, you know, more pro-Catholic, there was a huge influence of Kabbalism in Jesuit mentality. So there was there was a lot of Kabbalism thrown in there. And abstracted. Right? It's all abstracted. So what they'll do is they'll take the ideas from the Kabbalism and they'll abstract it for Jesuit training. So it's not exactly overt, but you'll find it if you're looking for it.
Sure.
Yeah, there's even
Go ahead, Nick.
No, there's even been people that I've come across that I've you know, maybe I think I did like a couple of shows, you know, mentioning old occultists from you know, back in the day. And there was a few Jesuits that I came across. I think one of them that I did cover. I mean, they were like Headless was saying. I was actually surprised to see, like, it's interesting how it's like, you know, you're supposedly the Catholic Church, but you're like fully entertaining gematria, Kabbalah, you know, all sorts of stuff that normally you'd be like, oh, no. But they were openly entertaining it then. They're openly entertaining it then, and it wasn't shunned upon. Very weird.
And that's within the Jesuit order?
Yeah. Athanasius Kircher was huge into that stuff.
Yeah.
They'll have specific people who will be basically in charge of that department. But if you're outside of the, you know, permission area, then they'll persecute you for looking into it.
Sure.
But they'll have certain people within the organization that they'll be like, you're in charge of this. As long as you're on our side, that's fine. I've had people who have known people in the London Freemasons, and they'll say, sure, at some point you will have to come across a decision, kind of like punching a baby in the face, right? And so if you punch the baby in the face and do what they ask you to, they'll take you in and put you in a specific division for, you know, people who have predilection towards evil. But if you punch the guy who's holding the baby in the face, Right. If you punch the guy who's holding the baby in the face and you say, I'm never going to do that, they'll put you in another division. The point isn't to actually get you to punch the baby. The point is to find out where they can place you. It's everything within the organization. That's why they have the white squares and the black squares. All of it within the organization. That's institutionalism. That's at the heart of all this stuff.
You're compartmentalizing the psychological, you know, aspects of your organization.
Right, and that was going on in the American Revolution, too. Everybody knows of John Hancock, right? He's the first signer of the Declaration of Independence. He's got the biggest signature. He put it out there for everybody to know. He was a smuggler, right? So the idea that the government was engaged in smuggling illegal substances goes all the way back to the founding of the country. I guarantee you, he wasn't just smuggling tea. That guy was definitely smuggling a lot worse stuff for a lot of people. Now, when you understand
pirates,
that, you...
what's often overlooked with many pirates is, you know, the Jolly Roger flag, of the famous flag of pirates. That was essentially the Knights Templar Navy. So, right. And
when you reach the 32nd degree, when you reach the 32nd degree in Freemasonry, they tell you, you are now a brother to all pirates at sea.
Yeah.
Wait a second.
Sense.
They're running the operations that are on both sides of the law. And that's very important to remember, because what we see as crime and outlaw and all the rest of that stuff, it's all a psychological operation. It really has nothing to do with the actual people involved, because the actual people involved, they're all part of the same lodges. I mean, you can find all sorts of information about all the serial killers in the 1970s and how closely related they are to a lot of these lodges, right? And that's because having the psychopaths...
Who are we talking?
Well, the clown killer, what's his name?
Gacy?
Gacy, he was an elk, right?
He was a Moose Lodge guy.
Moose Lodge, one of those.
Yeah, with this 33 flavor fucking balloon. That picture, if you ever see him holding that picture with the ice cream on it, it says 33 flavors.
Does it really?
Yes.
I have that picture on my phone. It's one of my favorite photos to troll people with.
There's 33 flavors on that motherfucker.
Nice. Yeah, I forgot he was a part of one of those social kind of... I don't really understand the dynamic of some of those mooses and elks and lions clubs, but they do seem like when you drive into towns, you can see who runs the town. They put a sign there with their, you know, their elks club meeting on Tuesdays, or you know what I mean? Rotary club meeting on Wednesdays.
Yeah, that was like in some special. It was that Mormon special with those people... That one guy, I can't remember his name, but he was like trafficking like the kids to like into Texas or something. And
Jeff.
And when they would show on they even showed it right there on the Netflix show. When they were entering, I think it was like El Dorado or wherever they were going, they showed like the sign on the highway showing you now entering so-and-so. And right there, another huge fucking sign is a post about the Masons, the free and accepted.
Yeah.
Masons. And I'm like, yo, you're showing us right there what the fuck was going on, probably.
No, they're strong in Texas. They're strong. The Masons are strong in Texas. I've witnessed that myself.
And I think Masonry is involved in
Mormonism. Speaking of the Jesuit strength in America, I would agree with you, Headless, in your assessment. I think they're one of the more powerful kind of secret societies, if you will. I mean, they're not really that secret, but, you know, secret societies in America, and they wield a lot of power, again, like you said, through the elite structures of the universities and whatnot, like to that regard, for sure, like places like Georgetown, you know, there's a lot of them. Georgetown obviously is one of the more prominent ones, but it's funny
because is the training for the political elites. You've got to basically go through Georgetown to get the okay before you can go into politics.
A lot of politicians and their kids have gone there.
Speaking of, what was that, Nick?
A lot of politicians and their kids have gone to the Georgetown.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's got a long history, though, for sure. Current politics and historically speaking.
You'll have, politicians that's, like, a Democrat, and you have a politician that's a Republican, and both their kids are going to the same school. They're both going to Georgetown.
And you get people like Hunter Biden or Bill Clinton who suddenly go into, like, Ivy League schools after Georgetown, which is highly unusual. Like, there's just some weird activity for people that come out of that establishment. But it is the original Jesuit stronghold in America. So that land was formerly Maryland, and Maryland and Pennsylvania were the only two of the original 13 colonies that refused to let the Catholics in. So it was illegal to be Catholic. You know, they blocked any advancements of settlements by any Catholic order in every colony except for Maryland, which the patron saint of Maryland is a Jesuit priest named Andrew White. And then Pennsylvania, because the Quakers were kind of like the hippies of the 18th century there. They were like, yeah, we'll let anybody in here. So it is funny that Georgetown is kind of the hotbed. It's always been the hotbed of Jesuit activity in this country. With, again, the Jesuit priest of the patron saint of Maryland, Andrew White.
Right. Well, it goes back way deeper than that, too. I mean, Maryland is the Catholic state. It is the Catholic state. Oh, for sure. Yeah. And so understanding that, you can understand why they would want to build a capital on a swamp, because the swamp was originally called Rome, Maryland. There are seven hills in Washington, D.C., so that's why they call it Rome, Maryland, because Rome is the city of seven hills. So they picked that for a very good reason. Now, again, this anti-Catholic sentiment didn't survive very long because it was Catholic planning that basically brought everything together. Keeping the capital in a place like Philadelphia would have definitely reduced the amount of Catholic influence, just sure, based off of the fact that it wasn't founded by, you know, Jesuits and Catholic priests. But as it is, I mean, if you watch the movie Exorcist, right, the very first one, you know, those steps where he falls down at the very end, he throws himself out the window and he falls down the steps, that's in Georgetown.
Oh, yeah, I've been there, yeah.
Smack dab in the middle of Jesuit country, and it's no coincidence that movie was filmed there, you know?
That makes sense. I mean, I think the Catholics and the Vatican's involved in a lot of filmmaking, not just like The Godfather or The Exorcist and some other stuff like that. But yeah, I think they will. I mean, they're the world's most wealthiest nation to this day. I often blame a lot of things on the Vatican. I don't know, maybe that's ingrained in my DNA as well, but I seem to think that they're responsible for a lot of tomfoolery.
Absolutely. Oh, right. So let's go back to the Battle of 1812, and let's talk about a little bit of the logistics here. So,
if I may interject real quick, with the Vatican, weren't they officially one of the opposing forces in the War of 1812? I think they're officially on record as being one of the opposing forces, if not actively fighting with like the Swiss Guard, but also using, because you know the, well, I'm sorry, maybe not the War of 1812, the 60 Years' War, the European side. Right, the European side of this conflict of the War of 1812, I think is what I'm thinking. So I think
they
were actually
surprised at all.
Yeah, I think they were actively involved with some of the Swiss Guard in that. Yeah,
right. They were the ones supporting the monarchy in France at the time of the French Revolution, and so having that sort of vestigial grip on France is really what drove their involvement. Now, in America, the idea of the Vatican controlling us at that time was a big threat, right? So you'll find all sorts of letters about how we have to keep the Vatican out of American affairs. We have to keep the Vatican out. We have to keep the Vatican out. Well, you know, what happened to that? Where did any of that anti-Catholicism go? Well, money took over that. So now, instead of looking at money,
to be a byproduct of the War of 1812, right? Like, because the Vatican started moving through the Northwest country, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin. They surged throughout this entire region, Iowa, taking over and settling, making a lot of Jesuit settlements as well during this time in the late 18 teens, early 1820s. So in the immediate aftermath of essentially what was the War of 1812 into what, 1814? I think officially.
Huge settler colonialism going on with multiple different groups, and the Catholic Church definitely put their footprint on the Midwest. That was their goal. Is the right. So the trade routes around the Great Lakes were by far the most valuable in the country at that time. And this is one of the reasons why controlling parts of Canada was on the agenda in American Congress. They really wanted to have the ability to kick the British out of their settlements around the Great Lakes region. Controlling the Great Lakes region was what the Battle of 1812 was all about. Now, they call it the Battle of 1812, but really it was kind of a continuation of the Revolution. And it was
absolutely. I mean, they're trying to get the land right back that they ceded in, at the first Treaty of Paris, right? In 1783, right. The British ceded the Northwest Territory to the Americans. And really what they're trying to do in the War of 1812 is take that land back, right?
Right, right. And more so or less. What they wanted to do is they wanted to go south into Canada. So in Detroit, the way you get to Canada is you actually have to go across the bridge south into Canada, because there's a part of land that juts out where the British had multiple forts, right? Mm-hmm. And so what they did was they said, this is where we will make our stand. This is the place to have this battle. We need to get rid of the British forts in this area. So they came across the river, or they came across the that area, and they started just setting fire to these forts and started doing, and they were met with immediate resistance. None of the settlers wanted the American army there. None of the soldiers wanted the American army there. And they all knew exactly what this was. This was just a huge clawback. And it was one of the ways that America was paying off the French, because what the French wanted to do is secure that entire Louisiana territory, right? They wanted to secure it by any means necessary. Well, so America decided that the best way to do that is to attack the closest enemy at a point where they could easily, you know, sweep down into the country, right? So anybody who tells you that the War of 1812 was a defensive action is just lying to you. It has nothing to do with defense, right? And if you're really going to study this war, you have to kind of admit that we lost it, right? So if your capital is burned to the ground, right, that means you lose, right? If everything you have in that area is now completely destroyed, you have to admit that you kind of lost. But
oh, for sure. Well, that's what I was getting at with the Jesuits and the Catholics moving in, because clearly there's, and you know, it's not really told that way, but clearly there's a, that was a precipitating event as a result of the War of 1812, is we lost to the crown, if you will, here in America.
Right.
And yeah, the siege of Washington and the burning of the White House is a notable affair in that endeavor.
Absolutely. And if you think the war propaganda is ridiculous today, how many people out there actually believe that we won the war, even though they sieged our capital and burned everything to the ground? Right?
Probably a lot of people. Because
take those two in comparison. Ukraine, which is, you know, Ukraine's going to win. Obviously, they're not. And they didn't. Right. But if it was in 1812, maybe a lot of Americans would have believed that. Well, there are still Americans who believe it to this day that, you know, somehow Ukraine's going to win. Slavo Ukraini, you know? I mean, well, it doesn't take much.
It's a good comparison, but I mean, you look at America today, we celebrate every 4th of July as Independence Day. Independent from what? Is my question.
Right. And if you don't know anything about...
When you lose the War of 1812 and cede all this land back to the crown, like, independent from what? You know?
Right.
And it's a continuation of events that spanned the Civil War and forward on in American history. But again, one of the major turning points here, is the loss of the War of 1812. It's not really described as a loss today. And obviously, if you burn someone's capital, that's a loss. You've taken over their home base and destroyed it, you know, in the whole grand scheme of things. Like if we were to go over and burn the Parliament or Westminster Abbey or whatever in the UK, obviously the Americans won, but that did not occur.
Right. So 1812 really represents the shift away from France and more pivoting towards England, right? And before this, we were very scared that England was going to invade and retake over the land, but England had a different idea. They wanted to take over all of our institutions. They wanted to take over Harvard. They wanted to take over Yale. They wanted to take over all of these things incrementally, piece by piece. And they did a fantastic job. I mean, we're still sort of the extension of the old British Empire today because of their success in the Battle of 1812, right? They were able to continue their influence.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. They did try to take over all the institutions following this time, and that's a concept often lost on what America was designed to be in the first place. With Thomas Jefferson, like, people often get confused why we use, you know, a different measurement system than the metric system. Well, that's because Thomas Jefferson demanded on getting away from the Crown's control system, even through science.
Right.
But no, and that's right. Again, so that's a good point. So you can see after the shift, after the, like you said, after the War of 1812, where this is grasping back not only just the land, but also the power within our institutions here in America. That's a good point.
Right, right. And so what we're experiencing today can't be put in focus without information and knowledge about this particular event. Now, I'd like to get into some of the personalities that were involved in this event, who were involved with the Battle of 1812. So if you've got more information about the Society of Cincinnati members involved directly in the Battle of 1812, let us have it, JJ.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, if I may make one point to jump on one of the points you just made there, Headless, the shift, like you said, yeah, there was a shift after the War of 1812 where obviously we're importing all these, the crown, if you will, the Vatican, the British, they're coming in, controlling stuff. We're relying on them for trade. Well, I think that's also because they beat the French too. So the British defeated the French Society at the same time. That's what the loss of, you know, the infamous defeat of Napoleon was about. So Napoleon was a lieutenant colonel during the French Revolution, part of the OG membership of the society on the French side, because the Society of Cincinnati being half French, half American forces within their organization. The American Revolutionary Army and the French Revolutionary Army were the original founders and members of the society. So Napoleon was an original member, you know, and he actually, following the French Revolution, King or General Lafayette, the counterpart to George Washington on the French side, he instituted, and this kind of speaks to what I like to look at is just the gray area that is often involved in a lot of these activities throughout history, because Lafayette installs his cousin, King Louis Philippe number two, I think, into power, and he immediately turns on the society, the new king does. Or I'm sorry, not King Louis Philippe, King Philippe, I think, number two. King Louis was before the Revolution. Anyway, he immediately flips on the society, throws all the generals in prison, kicks his cousin Lafayette out of the country. Now, it's Napoleon who takes power and, you know, sieges power a few years later and then releases all the generals from prison, including, Lafayette was even held at some point in time there as well. He had to release him. So, and that was why Lafayette came back to America and went on his reunion tour, because he was basically banned from France, you know, or was in fear to go back there following those kind of events that had transpired. He was a fairly young man during the war. I mean, he was much like Napoleon. They both were very young men at the French Revolution. So they were, you know, by the time these wars of, you know, 1812 were going on, the Napoleon Revolution there, this corresponding at the same time as the War of 1812, you know, those members of the society were very, like, whereas, like, George Washington's long past, a lot of the other guys from the American side are long past by this point in time. It's folks that were young men during the initial revolution, like Napoleon, Lafayette, and on this side, President James Madison would have been another example. He's the president during the War of 1812. He's the one who flees the White House, you know, during the siege. He was a captain during the American Revolution, therefore still, you know, still around doing, you know, presumably Society of Cincinnati activity. So I don't view the things that Madison's doing over here versus the things that Napoleon's doing over in France as necessarily separate activities. Because again, whatever they're up to, I suspect they were doing it collectively as a society, or at least somewhat collectively as the Society of Cincinnati. Right. But yeah, so I think we're seeing all these power shifts and folks turn on each other. It is tough to try to determine what really is going on there, but yeah, it's seems to be a lot of power shifting at the time from France to relying on England as well, not just America. And it seemed to be the defeat of the Society of Cincinnati, if you ask me.
The defining factor in the Society of the Cincinnati is pre-democracy, right? So all of the wars, right, all of the conflicts are taking place within the society first before any of the general public gets to decide on it, right? We don't get the information that they're privy to. And so the idea there is that there's a separation of knowledge from the general public to this society, and the society gets all that information first, the general public gets it second, and then the general public gets to decide as soon as the society has decided, right? And so we look at things like the Civil War, right? This was a conflict going on within the Society of Cincinnati way before it ever broke out into open warfare in,
for sure,
in America.
Well, it split the society in half, right? The society, the north and the south of the society, essentially, those chapters split, and then, you know, they went the way of the Union and the Confederacy, basically, or America did as a result of that split.
Exactly. But it was reflective of a lot of conflicts going on within the society way before the open conflict, way before Fort Sumter, way before any of that stuff. Right.
No, I agree with you. And I often look at it like a large family feud, because there was a large family feud, in my opinion, involved in the Civil War. I think it's more of a meta-analysis of that family feud concept involved with even all the wars of 1776, as I call them, but were often described by historians as the 60 Years War, dating from the French Indian War through the War of 1812. I think these are all dating before that, even back to the Knights Templar days, when they held a lot of the Templar were cousins with King John of Lackland and held him captive to sign a treaty of rights. Yeah, I know what you're saying, that, you know, these things, like, so what I look at is there's this internal feud that goes on, and that there's the spill out and fallout of it is what society deals with. I often relate it to the film series Star Wars. You know, if you look at Star Wars from like an objective angle, like the Skywalkers are a bunch of dicks. They're going around blowing up numerous galaxies. They're blowing up numerous planets. They're killing everybody in their path from both sides, the good or the bad, you know, like the Darth Vader side of the Skywalker or the Luke Skywalker. I mean, they're all just dicks. They're blowing everybody up and killing everybody in their way over some big family feud. And I often view a lot of the stuff with the society, specifically within American and French history and European history, is the same way.
Right.
So, but I see what you're saying, because that's a good point to make, that no one, like, I look at it like in American history, no one voted for a Continental Congress, right? It happened, and the product of it was pushed on everybody to decide, right? Like you said, but no one, there was not a vote held, and like, hey, should we have a Continental Congress? Should we do a constitution? You know, should we declare
Before that, they wanted to set up something that would be easily pushed out of the way. Right. Because they knew what they were doing at the time. And so the original, you know, eight presidents that we never talk about were just presiding over the Congress. That's why we call them presidents, because they just preside over the thing. Well, now we think that a president has to do everything. You know, they have to pass the laws. They have to do everything. No, really, they were just there to, you know, recognize people to come forward and speak about certain bills. Right. That was their job. Right. But the whole point that they wanted to make was that we want power to be centralized, because if power is centralized in these specific presidents who are just presiding over the Congress, then we can have more direct control over the decisions that are made. Right. All of this stuff is oligarchy. It has absolutely nothing to do with democracy. Right. That's always the case. And, you know, to go even further than that, there's never been a separation between church and state. The church is the state. Always has been, right? So when people think that, you know, they're atheists or whatever and they're progressives, they're worshiping the state. Where do they even draw the line at worship? Do they even know what that word means, you know? So all the time you hear them saying our democracy, what you should be hearing is their God, right? Our democracy is our God. And that's what they
believe. Pretty accurate description.
Anytime they want relief, anytime they want anything, they always go to the government first. It's always their, you know, it's always their Santa Claus. It's everything to them. And that is a psychological condition, right? That is deeply held religious beliefs, right?
Well, so let me interject real quick, Headless. Yeah. Well, who is their God, right? That's a good point, but who is their God, right? If we're talking, especially if we're talking about the society, right? Who worship?
Who is the society's God? I would go to their eagle symbolism, right? So the eagle symbol for the Society of the Cincinnati is connected to all of the other eagle cults throughout history, right? So let's start in recent history. What's a big eagle cult you can name? The Nazis, right? Okay. They had the eagle cult.
Obviously the first one that comes to mind.
Right. So they've got the standard of the eagle on top of the swastika, and that's their eagle cult. And then you go back a little bit and you find that all of these Germanic empires always have this eagle. Well, let's go all the way back to ancient Greece. They were an eagle cult. Let's go back to Rome. They were an eagle cult. Anytime you see this eagle, it's a representation of the throne of heaven, right? So the throne of heaven is the concept that there is a ruler over all these empires, and he gets to basically command and control the minds of the people who are engaging in this process of statehood, state making. Right.
Sure.
Originally, according to the Greek mythology, that was Uranus. Right. Uranus had the throne of heaven. He was, Uranus basically means sky. Right. So he's the sky god. And what do we say when we're done praying? Amon. Amon.
Right.
Amon is the Egyptian sky god. Right.
Sure.
He's got blue skin because he's part of the sky. He's part of the dark sky. So you've also got this god Zeusamon that the Greeks created while they were occupying Egypt. And Zeusamon was the combination of both Zeus and Amon,
right.
Two sky gods, right? Two eagle right. cults, throne of heaven right there. You know, and the throne of heaven, the seat of it, kind of looks like maybe sitting on the back of Nut, right? Because Nut is like a big bench.
Yeah.
You know, she's sort of covering the sky. That's sort of the idea of this feminine aspect to the sky god. What do we have? District of Columbia. Columbia, the goddess.
Well, let's see, I think you're spot on with some of the eagle cult references through time, but I think more importantly is the goddess worship within the Society of Cincinnati, and that's probably, again, dating back through their heritage, the big beef for the Vatican, because the Vatican was like anti-goddess worship throughout history. And the heritage of ancestry through these society members, families, are all through goddess worship, different goddess worship iterations throughout time, throughout history of European and back into the Holy Land, if you will. But yeah, I think that Columbia is their most important figure within the society. That's my opinion. And again, it's their Columbia is a goddess that seems to be mashed together of Athena. With you might be able to do better with some of these than I do. Artemis, and there's another one, and it starts with an
Diana.
H.
So Artemis is the goddess of the wilderness, right? And so it all kind of civilized it. If you read the book, The Golden Bough by James George Frazer, it's a huge tome, but basically he focuses in on this Golden Bough ritual at Lake Nemi, right? The reflecting pool. Mm-hmm. They call it the mirror of the goddess, right? And what do we have in Washington, D.C.? We've got the reflecting pool. Right. We've got the reflecting pool there. Now, what would happen at this Lake Nemi is there would be a king of the grove, right? Which would be an escaped slave or a escaped convict who would go and pull the top bough off of this tree and then challenge the old king of the grove. Now, he and the old king would fight to the death. Whoever would win would remain the king of the grove, and he would consecrate the district or the area to Diana. He would consecrate the district to Diana.
Interesting.
District to Diana.
Right.
District
right.
of Columbia. Right?
Right.
So what they would do is, you know, after they were done fighting to the death and they had this basically human sacrifice ritual, is that it would bring peace and prosperity to the region. And this goes back to the Etruscans. This was done before the Romans took over at the Etruscans. So this ritual went on and on until I believe it was, emperor with Nero, right? So Nero fixed the battle. Right. So he wanted to be have his guy as the king of the grove. So he fixed the battle and everybody knew it. And they're like, well, Nero kind of screwed this whole ritual up for us. So we're going to kind of ignore it. But the idea is you get a free man who's not part of these inner secret societies as your front man for the king of the grove. Right. And what do we see every 4 years? We have this election where this free man is their front man for the secret society families, and they have a huge ritual right there on the balcony overlooking the reflecting pool, right, of Lake Nemi, or, you know, the reflecting pool in Washington, D.C.
Yeah,
now, you can trace Columbia straight back to Diana Nemerensis. It's right there. But let's look at the flag of Virginia for a second. What do you see there? You got the goddess standing on top of the tyrant, right? Thus always the tyrant. So you could see that as being very closely related to Diana. And even before Diana, that would probably be most closely associated with the Hindu goddess of destruction. Right?
Oh, yeah.
She's in the same pose. Kali, right? She's in the same pose as Kali. And if you look back throughout all the mythology around Artemis, she's always associated with human sacrifice. Artemis and Diana are basically indistinguishable. They just started calling Diana, you know, Diana Artemis in Roman times.
No, for sure. I'm glad you made that point. That's a great point, because I think that we can loop that back to what you were saying before about the War of 1812, because I think part of this goddess worship of this Diana, Artemis, Hecate was the other one I couldn't think of.
I was thinking that.
It's mashed in there. Yeah, supposedly, you know, that there's elements of Hecate mashed into this Columbia figurehead for the society. So I think a lot of that worship does lead to this warlike mindset, because, and we have a, you know, a history of nothing but war, right? I mean, in this country, and you have a group that venerates that, like you said, thus the tyrants. Well, it depends on who your tyrant is, right? I mean, sometimes I agree with who their tyrant is, but other times I feel like, you know, especially in recent years, it seems like the American public's become the tyrant.
Right, right. Well, they keep talking in early American history about how they don't want it to turn into a tyranny of the majority. Well, they did a pretty good job of making sure that never happens with the Society of Cincinnati, because that's not even elected. You don't have any sort of recourse whatsoever with society matters. None. You know?
And they're the ones who control the military. Internally spill out over to the general public. I mean, I always propose the JFK assassination, which we briefly spoke before offline today, as a society feud. Like that's an internal feud from the society, because you have Lee Harvey Oswald, who was very probably a hereditary member of the society because his father had passed when he was younger, you know, so he would have been passed on that membership through his second great grandfather, who was I believe a major from the Georgia chapter of the Society of Cincinnati, part of the Georgia militia. And then you have JFK, who didn't have that hereditary membership, but by virtue of being the front man, as you pointed out, he's as a president of the United States, he's offered membership within the society from being in that role. However, he doesn't have the hereditary membership that Oswald would have. So I think some of these beefs within the society again occur, and then they spill out to the American public, impacting the American public at large. Yeah. And it's not, there's nothing democratic about it.
Another interesting thing about the flag of Virginia is the reverse side, that it doesn't show that on the flag, but on the reverse side, she has three sisters, and Diana Nemerensis has three sisters. She's a triple goddess, just like Hecate.
Oh, interesting. Right?
So Diana Nemerensis is very, very, very closely related. Now, if we look on top of the Capitol building, there's Statue of Freedom up there. Very clearly, that is Artemis. Very, very clearly. Now, there was an interesting feud going on within the society about that statue specifically. They wanted to put on her head a Phrygian cap, right? They wanted to put a Phrygian cap on her head.
Yep.
Right. And that pissed off Jefferson Davis, because Jefferson Davis didn't want the symbol of a freed slave to be put on their symbol of freedom. Yeah. Right. So Jefferson Davis threw a big fit. He's like, no, you will not put a Phrygian cap. Now, again, all of these people know very specifically what this symbol means. They all know what these symbols mean. Right. So anybody giving me
the Statue of Liberty used to be sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Hey guys, quick life hack. If someone called Wetzina 6969 messages you on Instagram, do not engage. She's not real. Please do not send her airfare to fly from Egypt. She's not coming. It's all a lie. Your boy has been done up like a kipper. Like Napoleon, I dared to be great. But Wetzina 6969 was my Waterloo.
Wow. Well, anybody giving me the whole song and dance about how, oh, no, these are just artistic.
Oh, I hate
it's
that.
It's not. It's intrinsic.
No. Yeah, and the Statue of Liberty used to be depicted with that same, how'd you pronounce it, Phrygian cap?
Yeah.
Phrygian cap, there we go. I always mess that pronunciation of that one up.
Right, there's a bunch of weird things going on in Turkey, right? One of those things is Phrygia, right? So Phrygia in Turkey and Friesland up in the northern Germanic region, right? That's where the Rhine has its entrance. You've got these two places existing in Turkey, right? So you got Friesland or Phrygia, right? That's what they call the people from Friesland is Phrygians, right?
Yep.
And they also have Phrygia down in Turkey, which is like the central part of Anatolia. And you've also got another group, which would be the Gauls in Galatians, yep. Right? We know that from the Bible. Tribes. Galatians, right? That's in Turkey too, right? Mm-hmm. So the Gaul or the French are in Turkey and the Phrygians are in Turkey somehow. I don't know how that works, but all those names are right there, and they freely admit, yeah, these were people from Northern Europe coming down using their Proto-Indo-European languages and spreading their culture throughout this region.
Yeah,
and we don't think very much about that, but like the entire Proto-Indo-European migration really has a big deal to play with American history, and we could see that in the ethnic distribution here. If you look at the distribution of Germans and where they decided to settle in the United States, all concentrated in the Midwest region, right?
Sure.
Because it's the most similar to the region that they came from.
No,
strange, right? And you look at the Northern Highlands you've got the Northern Highlands of England, right? And where do they settle? Well, they settle in the Appalachia.
Yeah, right? Scots because Irish.
It's the same mountain range. The mountain range literally makes a big hook from America all the way down into England, all the way down through the Scotch-Irish region. It's the same mountain range. And they're just settling back in their old regions. So, I mean, there's got to be a lot of ancestral memories happening with the settlement of the United States, because it's almost like we're not even living consciously. You know, we're not trying to change. We're all tracked back to our origins. And unless we're aware of it, we'll just forget and fall back into these same old cycles that we fall into over and over again.
Well, that's a good point, because I don't think we know a lot about the actual American history, because if you look at, you mentioned before the Louisiana Purchase and that being a focal point within this War of 1812 saga. Well, that land, you know, by all appearances, was claimed by the Knights Templar back in 1364. So essentially, it's Templar after the Templar. This is post Templar put down. So the remnants of the Templar came over here and made land claims in what was probably their fishing land, and for many years over here in North America, where they had intermingled with the natives, which was very common. Seemingly within the history of like places like Nova Scotia with the Mi'kmaq tribes, and the Mi'kmaq tribes actually play into the War of 1812 saga as well.
I thought that they were important in things, because there's like a lot of Mi'kmaq stuff. I think even kind of like in occult symbolism, you kind of see like almost the same style, the same symbols in a way. And I think there was even like possibly something with Skinwalker Ranch when we covered that. I think
maybe. With the Mi'kmaqs, huh?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Interesting.
I mean, they had some very Templar heritage. They're just looking at their flags and some of their languages. They obviously live in around the predominantly from and around the Nova Scotia area, which is New Scotland. Which, you know, there's a lot of correlations between those two cultures. And again, I think that's part of the history of America that's not told. Because when the Vikings became Christianized and became the Normans and the Normans out of Normandy, France, you know, as their kind of their kingdom headquarters, they didn't just invade the United Kingdom in 1066. They invaded North America, and in Nova Scotia today, you can find the Law and Saw Meadows civilization, or you know, a city that used to exist there. and it's a bunch of these Viking long homes that look very mound-like, you know, with grass on top of them and whatnot. And that was built, I believe they recognize today as a story instead of 1066. So again, this was we don't really know, the lack of knowledge in American history doesn't just start in 1812 or 1776 or 1600s. It goes back to 1066, you know, we're not recognizing that the ancestors of the people we call the founding fathers and other kinfolk of those same families, they're coming to America 1,000 years ago, settling up these places like Longsaw Meadows, no different than the same time these same Knights Templar ancestors or Society of Cincinnati ancestors through the Templar, back to the Normans, back through some of these Viking families when they became Christianized in the Normans. Again, they took over a lot of different places, the United Kingdom, America, the island of Sicily, you know. The Sicilian Italians are significantly different in heritage from the regular mainland Italians because the Normans invaded Sicily as well. I mean, again, much of Italy was controlled by.
If you pull up the Sicilian flag, yeah, that's a really interesting flag, because you also got to pull up the Isle of Man flag, because you get the same Triskelion in both of them.
Nice. I'm not familiar with the Isle of Man flag. Yeah. No, but my point being in that long-winded, I appreciate y'all entertaining my long-winded adventure there, the path I went on. But yeah, it's a history we claim to know but don't really know. You know what I mean? Like, we don't fully understand what's going on. We just see that there's obviously these same secret societies or families, you know, involved throughout time in all of these sagas.
Right.
If I may add one more point on your comment on relative to the War of 1812, try to circle back there with some of the stuff. The Jefferson Davis you mentioned did not want Phrygian hat. What are you calling it?
Phrygian cap.
Phrygian. There we go. I always mess that one up, no matter how many times I try. The he was a very prominent member even at the time of the War of 1812. You know, he was a captain in the U.S. I believe captain or maybe major in the U.S. Army. He actually was assigned to guard a bunch of mounds over on the Mississippi River in Iowa, what is now known today as the Effigy National Park. It's a bunch of effigy mounds that are over there in Iowa today, sitting on the Mississippi River. And that's where he was stationed. He was essentially, you know, stationed to set up a fort there and guard that area for some reason. I you know, there's a lot of mound stuff that goes on with the War of 1812, no different than the Revolutionary War and the Civil War, but I think Jefferson Davis specifically, that's interesting that he was stationed in what seemingly was an important mound site because it was later becoming a national park mound site.
There's a Sicilian flag.
Yep. It's a wild flag too.
That's Medusa with wings and sheaves of grain. Right. And the Triskelion is very much associated with Hecate. Right.
Right.
And do you have the Isle of Man flag? Ah, there we go. Isle of Man.
Nice.
Flag. Nice Triskelion.
It's almost identical.
you know what I found interesting about this? Especially, I didn't even know this was what I was going to see. As soon as I saw it, I've actually made posts about this symbol before. It's almost exactly like the same thing that's on cops' body cams. It's a certain company that makes a body cam. Their logo is just like that up in the corner. I found that to be very fucking shady.
Oh, really?
That's interesting. The logo.
You know what company that is?
I'd have to look.
Is it Taser? Taser makes a lot of body cams. Like the actual, you know, like electronic control devices, the little shockers, you know? The stun guns, if you will.
Look at the Isle of Man geographically, it is placed directly in the middle of all of the United Kingdom, right?
Right.
And so I think it's no coincidence that these Normans would be making that that distinction of them being sort of like the middle of the Triskelion, which would be, you know, between Scotland, between England, between Ireland, all that stuff. They're the hub, right? Isle of Man is the hub.
That's a good
point. Now, people in England like to make fun of people on the Isle of Man because, you know, they're kind of hicks. They're kind of backcountry, you know. If you come from the Isle of Man, you've got a very distinct accent, and they sort of think that you're a backwards type person. But I don't think it was always that way, you know.
yeah,
hillbilly.
Well, it's interesting. So that symbol is related to Hecate, then, huh?
Yeah. Triskelion is and yeah. Where's Hecate worship located? Back to Turkey, Anatolia.
Right. Well, and I mean, so, if you want to trace the Knights Templar and their alleged ancestral, you know, bloodlines, that also goes back to Turkey. The quote unquote historical Jesus was apparently a king from the kingdom of Edessa, which is like modern day St. Lurfa, Turkey, kind of the Syria, northern Syria, southern Turkey, eastern border, right. Southeastern.
So the southeastern border.
The story of Cincinnati goes back to Turkey. Oh, Axon. Okay. Oh, nice.
There you go.
Good find.
Nice Triskelion.
I saw that show. I was like, yo, that looks familiar. And I was like, yo, that's always in the top corner whenever we're shown footage, body cam footage on the news. That's
a good point. Yeah, I did not recognize that before.
Yeah, that's worth looking into. I guarantee you they might have some Norman background in there.
Right. They also control a significant amount of surveillance, don't they? Because you know they can hack into that stuff internally from the company. There's no way they can't access their own software wherever it's at. Right. You know what I mean? So I always look at companies that have such control over a market like that. That's a lot of surveillance they have control over. So it would make sense to be one of these families.
After Obama basically mandated that all police officers wear the body cam, it was that company specifically that got the contracts for all of it. That's not an accident.
Oh, I did not realize that. Interesting.
Right.
I've never worn body cameras before. It must have been pretty military police passed.
I assumed it had to be pretty huge because, like, the only reason I even noticed it is, like, seeing so many different body cams constantly having it. I was like, oh, it's, you know, what is that? Oh, that looks familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so it is used constantly. You will see that constantly if you pay attention to, like, body cam footage.
Right. Add another leg, and what do you get?
Swastika?
Oh, yeah.
Swastika, yep.
Took me too long.
Yes, you do.
Wow.
But I think Cincinnati also has some history back to Turkey, to ancient Turkey. And,
well, I believe it was...
A lot of the mounds have history back to ancient Turkey. A lot of the mounds, the oldest Adena mounds, the best interpretation of the language I've seen in those mounds from the tablets have been... The known tablets have been recovered that we have record of still today because there's lots of tablets have been lost, is ancient Hittite, which is like this, you know, roughly around the same time these Adena mounds are being built, but a culture that existed in modern-day Turkey.
Proto-Hebrew, ancient Hittite.
Yep, Proto-Hebrew, yep.
Yep, there you
so
go, yeah.
A lot of stuff that goes
there's a connection. We're just not being told about it. And these people remember because they're putting it on their freaking body cams.
No, but that's great that that's connected to Hecate because it seems to infer then a much longer lineage of this goddess worship of Hecate within these same families, right? So it's not just the society of Cincinnati using that in the Columbia goddess, you know, characteristics, mashing Hecate in there, but it seems to be that that's possibly for some, which I've often alleged with these families, past knowledge bases passed down through the bloodlines, right? So that seems like that's with a hereditary membership like the society, that makes sense that they're passing down to the paternal stuff. But before the society, how was this stuff getting passed down? It was clearly getting passed down through the same bloodlines, it seems.
Right, right. Yeah. And I believe these bloodlines go all the way back to ancient Sumeria, and they know who they are. They advertise it, you know?
Oh,
they advertise
have
it.
Have you ever been on the Mormons genealogical database, FamilySearch.org? They go back way before BC, like thousands of years BC, like or at least hundreds of centuries of BC.
You know, when I covered Skinwalker Ranch, I basically used their own shit to show who the Mormons were that were involved. I got almost all their shit from their own sites because they show so much family lineage if they have it. It's pretty creepy.
I agree.
Actually.
I think
much like the society. Much like
exactly
the society, it's all an open secret. If you just read their own literature, they'll tell you, and they'll try to pass it off as not being important. You have to have the connections to understand what is important about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they have, like, pictures of, like, Strawberry Fields Reservoir in, like, Utah that I was, like, just looking at. You know, or, like, the militia that the Mormons had. They had photographs, you know, if it's whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But I was just like, yo, like, you could actually find some of the craziest random shit on their fucking sites if you use it.
It's a good data. Yeah, they're good databases for sure. Lots of information to be yielded from there. Mm-hmm. Pictures, articles, all sorts of stuff. Birth records, death records, marriage records.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Family trees in general.
This takes us up to, I believe, the culmination of the Battle of 1812, which was the Louisiana Purchase. Right? Yeah. I believe that marks the end of this phase. And so France is finally retreating from North America. That we sort of have an agreement with France that we're always going to keep Haiti down. We're going to keep our foot on the backs of the Haitians forever. I mean, you look at the difference between one side of the island of Hispaniola and the other, you understand that that's not an accident, right? It's been that way for centuries.
Right.
So at the end of the Battle of 1812...
You could technically say that a member of the Society of Cincinnati has specifically been putting his food on the necks of Haiti since around 1982, and that man is Bill Clinton.
Yep.
Whether or not he was a member of the Society in 82, he was a member a decade later when he became president. But around 82 or so, I think it was when he was governor of Arkansas, early, mid-80s, 84 maybe, he was forcing the Haitians to quit growing rice and buy all rice from the state of Arkansas. So they were importing all rice from the state of Arkansas. That's just one example of keeping the boot on the necks of the Haitians over the years from a society perspective.
It's America's oldest tradition. Stomping on the backs of the Haitians. And, you know, that all goes back to France because the Haitians booted out the French. They had a voodoo revolution. And basically these, you know, living zombies were unstoppable. This is what the French said, right? So they had their voodoo priests and they basically created an army of people who couldn't be shot down. And so after that point, they're like, we need infiltration and we need embargoes right now. And so that's what America has been doing ever since on behalf of France. So,
sure. Do you see like some of their politics and their voodoo stuff seeming to mingle in with these secret societies in America? Because it seems to be that there is
absolutely
sort of,
agreement there. Okay, so the Clinton Foundation, viewed Haiti as their private playground, right? So they would kidnap kids from Haiti.
$10 billion in donations there just between that was actually the Bush Clinton Foundation in that instance with the $10 billion that they evaporated.
Right. And it's not just them. It's also Jeffrey Epstein. So Jeffrey Epstein would also threaten his victims with voodoo dolls.
Oh,
he was big into voodoo.
Yeah.
I believe he was trained. Right. He was trained by, you know, some of the Haitian voodoo priests because that was the Clinton Foundation home base. So.
Yeah.
If he wanted to, he could just go down there and learn all of the Haitian ritual magic he needed to because basically his buddy owned the place.
Yeah, and on paper, he started the Clinton Global Initiative, so he's deeply ingrained within that whole machine work. That's a good point about – because, again, I've long suspected Epstein to be involved in some sort of ritual ceremonial magic, so that's a good point of where likely source of some of that knowledge he learned was. But, yeah, I think there is some sort of handshake between some of these secret societies within American political power structures and the Haitian stuff. But, yeah, there does seem to be a concerted effort to keep Haiti – the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. I believe that's the current
rate. See how many people you can kill with a natural disaster. I think that's the purpose of Haiti. It's just to see how high the body count can go.
You know? Yeah, maybe it was like a testing ground for weather manipulation or something.
Yeah, earthquakes.
The UN went in there and just started dumping their waste, dumping their feces into the river. Just to, you know, see how many people they can kill with dysentery. And they killed a lot. It was like 10,000 people they killed with their contaminated water, you know, because people get their water from the river in Haiti. So they just dumped all their waste in the river upstream and it killed a lot of people. And they're like, we're sorry. We killed 10,000 people. Above everything else, you got to keep the blue hats out. If you see UN troops in your area, you need to either leave or put up a stand because they are going to destroy you. They are the worst.
Right.
Everywhere they go, they are the worst.
True. Yeah, true. I wanted to add this. I hate to interrupt, but I just don't want to forget. I had texted my brother because he's, you know, I've mentioned before, he's a cop. And I knew I had sent him a picture of it, and he's like, oh, yeah, that's the same one we use. So when I couldn't remember the name, I had texted him, and I find this funny that he even said this back. I said, what's the name of the body cam you use? And then I found it, and I said, Axon. I found it. Forget it. And he said, yeah, Axon. He says, funny, if I'm not mistaken, there was a bid who we were going to use for that, and we went for another company. And then Axon said, fuck you, and bought the other company. So now we still have to use them, even though we didn't want to go with them.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, because I mean, there used to be different manufacturers, so it sounds like they're buying out some of those other manufacturers, huh?
So you just bought out the competition that they wanted to choose to go with when the contract ended. Wow.
Right.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, there's a lot of surveillance data in those videos. So there's a inside of people's homes, all sorts of stuff. You know, you can yield from
it's
that
a huge industry. So here's one aborted aspect that they haven't really gone back to yet, but they probably will. It's called the PAT scan. If you look up PAT scan, it's a Patriot scanner company. Basically, it's a detector that they put at the doors of hotels and shopping malls that they want to scan everybody as they enter into it. And they put this forward the same day as the Las Vegas shooting. Put that forward. They haven't gone back to it yet.
Sheldon Adelson and the DHS guy were involved in that, right?
Yes, sir. Sheldon Adelson and the DHS Chertoff. Yep. They were both heavily involved in this company. It hasn't come out yet, but it will be. It will be.
Yeah,
They're not going to miss the next opportunity.
Yeah, they seem pretty serious about that. Yeah, it's that's a very intrusive technology.
Some sort of device that I've seen mentioned before in the past. I forgot the name of it, but it was like something that was like portable, and they were able to like drive around and supposedly like turn it on, and actually just be able to like see the identity of pretty much all the people around them. It was something weird like that.
Backscatter? Like a portable backscatter machine? They put them in like big vans, like a big cargo delivery style UPS style trucks?
Called. I don't know, but I remember seeing some shit like that. I was like, what the fuck?
It's like a larger version of what you see at the airport when going through those kind of scans. It's the same backscatter technology.
Well, they've got radio transmitters that can basically pick up all of your data. All of your data. What are they called for the cops? They've got this like suitcase. It's like a shark or something. I forget the name of it. But basically,
maybe that's what
it intercepts. It intercepts all cell phone data. They can look you up on the spot and know everything about you. And they probably even flag you in different ways. So as soon as you're pulled over,
it's like a cell phone tower.
Right.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It's a false cell phone tower that just collects everything. So
sorry to get off of 1812 with that thing. But
no, it's fine.
Yeah, I just thought that was weird. I mean, it's like, hey, you know, what a coincidence, too, you know.
Right. No, I think we actually made some good points there because like I look at circumstances like the Las Vegas situation with this implementation of this new, you know, obviously unreasonable search as far as unreasonable searches go relative to the Constitution. You know, you should have an expectation of privacy not to get your entire body scanned every time you walk into a facility. I think whether or not those machines would actually survive constitutional challenges in courts, it's hard to tell in the current state of justice in America and the court system. But I would call that unreasonable level of search. And I think that goes back to what my overarching point with a lot of these things are, dating back to the War of 1812. I'm sure there were folks internally in the United States that were happy to assist the British, right, within taking back over this country. And when I say people, I mean like within the elite structures or the power political structures within America, the wealthy political power structures, much like we see today with people like Sheldon Adelson, right? Sheldon Adelson is apparently happy to fund these sort of ventures. He's an American citizen or was an American citizen. He's passed, I believe. But he was happy to fund these ventures to infringe upon people's rights from not a governmental perspective, right, but just a general perspective of whatever forces he's operating within, which could be related to the elements of the government or could be related to, like we said before, the world kind of global kind of elements of power, right, which is the crown, if you will, or the Vatican. And, you know, and that's really, again, who was behind the War of 1812. From my perspective, I see those people, again, as we've already discussed, they're seizing institutions, they're seizing property. Like, they're just taking this place back over, in my opinion. Right. And they try to do it even when American forces fought back between the War of 1812 and the Civil War, they were ready to do with the Civil War because the Vatican and, well, again, the Crown, generally speaking, was supporting forces on both the northern border and the southern border, ready to take back over America had Abraham Lincoln not found some sort of resolution to the matter. And then once again, you find conspirators of Abraham Lincoln's assassination being you know, hidden by the Vatican for years. It became a very big issue, politically speaking, where the U.S. is ready to cut off the Vatican relations, diplomacy over the matter. Unless they
Maryland.
Get the
guy, so,
yep, and it all went down in Maryland.
Yep. So an interesting part of the first part of the presidency of George Washington is the rebellion that he put down, right?
Sure, the Whiskey Rebellion.
The Whiskey Rebellion, right? So the very first thing he did is he went after the whiskey producers for not paying taxes. Now, how much of our mythology is about taxation without representation?
Right.
You know, we all say, oh, that's why we went to war with the British. Well, that didn't really hold up within the first few years of the presidency because clearly George Washington didn't feel the same way about taxation without representation as he did just a few years earlier.
But if I may offer an alternative perspective to that, I like where you're at, but if I may offer an alternative perspective. What if this taxation of the whiskey is the story we're sold today and throughout this British reinstitutionalized America that's occurred, especially more progressively since the War of 1812? But because, and I say that because the first free city in America that Washington started in 1783, in September of 1783, following the Treaty of Paris, was Washington, Pennsylvania, and that just happened to be the location of the area of where this Whiskey Rebellion was taking place. So I often wonder, is there more to that story, right? Was there more issues? And again, prior to that area becoming Washington, PA, getting back to the War of 1812 business, Washington was one of the commanding officers in that area for the British Army and led his, during the French and Indian War, and led the commanding officer of the British Army in America, General Braddock, to his demise. I often think that was intentional and not just some sort of ambush. As historians will say, like, oh, well, George Washington and some of the other folks got ambushed. But the people that survived were all members of the society, later become members of the Society of Cincinnati, prominent members. I actually have three or four forefathers that were on that mission of the ambush of General Braddock. They all survived. You know what I mean? Like they all lived. So it's, again, was it an ambush, or was George Washington and fellow future members of the society, including people like Meriwether Lewis, or I'm sorry. Yeah. Meriwether Lewis, I believe was his father, grandfather, Colonel Nathaniel Meriwether. He was another prominent officer, right? So you have, from the Lewis and Clark people, they were members of the society, Cincinnati, years later, right? But I'm saying in the years preceding, during, that would ultimately end with the War of 1812, these French and Indian Wars, and again, George Washington at the onset of those activities there, and it involves the same area of activities that we're talking about with this Whiskey Rebellion. So I often just wonder, like, what the truth is and all that. Because, again, another important fact about that geographical area is those are some of the oldest mounds and cave drawings we have in America or in that same area as the Whiskey Rebellion. So just an alternative perspective on those activities.
For that, I'd like to remind you of the one major similarity between George Washington and Donald Trump. They're both real estate developers.
That's a good point.
So that's what he was engaged in, right? He was developing real estate. And one of the main points of contention that a lot of people had with George Washington was the amount of land seizures that he was doing during his presidency. And so I think that whole Washington, Pennsylvania, that was a project of his.
It probably was.
Right.
And
so a lot of the people around it did not like that project going forward on their land. And so you got to send in the army.
Possible. But I often wonder what the actual feuds were. I mean, we're sold to the feud with the taxes today, but like, I look at it more of there's these feuding secret societies type of environment, and the rest of American society in general is just, left to deal with it. So maybe these people were butthurt because they were left to deal with, is what I'm getting at, right?
Right. Right.
They're like, why are these Skywalkers destroying my town or my planet like in Star Wars? And they're butthurt exactly. over it. That's the way I look at these circumstances, yeah. Like, I'm not sure if it was taxes related. I know it's sold as that. It's often described, well, George Washington ran a competing distillery, what, 400, 300 miles, you know, east of there? I mean, that doesn't make any sense, right? There wasn't distribution channels of whiskey 300 miles at that point. It would make no sense. You're doing everything by horseback. So that's what I'm saying. With this whole tax thing becomes this whole notion that he was trying to eliminate competing whiskey distilleries because he had a whiskey distillery in Old Town Alexandria that still sits there today, but
right
in Virginia, yeah, it's still a bar. I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head now. I want to call it Francis Tavern, but that's where he gave his victory speech in New York City. Was Francis Tavern? That still sits there today as well.
Didn't he create the layout for Alexandria? He was the surveyor for the area. And
he
put all that together. So if you really want to see the mind of George Washington at work, go to Alexandria, Virginia, because he put that whole thing there. And his Masonic Memorial Temple is right there on the highest hill in Alexandria. So if you want to see the mind at work, that's the place.
And so I'm glad you brought that up because I actually was recently at that. Took another visit to that Masonic temple not that long, a couple months ago, and I realized he kind of has his own brand of Freemasonry. Speaking of these different brands of Freemasonry, there's a series of George Washington lodges within the I think it's within the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. I relearned a lot about Freemasonry on that visit because I hadn't even heard of some of these other brands of Freemasonry. And Headless or Nick, you might be familiar with it. It's like one of the weirder ones I saw was, besides like the Shriners and stuff like that, was or the Jesters for that matter. They have like a museum in the George Washington Lodge on like the second floor, with all these different brands of Freemasonry. One was called like the Enchanted Wizards of the I'm trying to remember the name of it right now, but
aren't they considered
instead of lodges?
Yes, and I think they might be considered like the Black Hatted Fezzes or something like that too.
Yeah, so,
yes, I've come across that. Once, what did you say you think the name was again?
Something about enchanted. The word enchanted is definitely in there. Something maybe enchanted wizards of the of. I don't want to say of the grotto because I think the grottos are their version of lodges. Like, but I mean, if I had heard of it before on my previous trip to that temple, I'd forgotten about it because it was blew my mind learning about this different brand of Freemasonry that existed.
Mystic Order of Veiled Prophets of the Enchanted Realm.
There you go.
Nice.
I mean, it's a cool name, right?
Yeah.
What they do with Freemasonry, I have no idea, right? Like, that just seems like if anyone's up to some bizarre stuff in Freemasonry, I'm going to start looking at the Enchanted Wizards over there.
And I was, wow. One of them has fucking Sinatra on it. Sin, A, and then T-R-A. One of their hats. But it does say for a few years, the Mystic Order of Veiled Prophets of the Enchanted Realm had no official emblem to wear. Word got around that the Mystic Order of Veiled Prophets were permitted to wear an emblem that set them apart from others, and a black fez head covering was selected.
There you go. Yep. Nice. I saw some of them fezes on the picture, yep. Interesting group. There wasn't a lot of information. I wasn't able to readily find a lot of information. I haven't dove too deep into it, but I just want to know what they're like. What is this brand of Freemasonry do? Like, what's their shtick? You know, like, what are they involved in?
Sometimes I think these inner orders are a little bit more specific on maybe ideas or like what their objective is or like what their part of the community is. Or some of them I would even wonder if they're like, I hate, you know, like psyops or like just organized crime, really, in some way.
It's right.
I view it very similar to like a bag of tools for a mechanic, right? So you've got society, which would be the car. And then you've got the mechanics, which would be these orders and inner orders of the Freemasonry. And then they've got this bag of tools, which would be all these different branches of Freemasonry and how they spread out into society. Now, again, it's all decided on before it ever reaches the lodge. So the lodge would be the public-facing aspect or maybe underworld-facing aspect. So if you look at it like that, things like the Society of the Cincinnati start to make a little bit more sense because what they have to do is they have to come to these conclusions before it ever reaches the general public. So once they've sort of made their mind up, because it's all done in collective voice. It's, if you've ever read The Economist magazine, they put everything in collective voice and they don't list authors, right? That's sort of how things are done within the orders. Like everything is done 100% in agreement by the time it reaches the general public, right? Sure. That's really the only way you can manage a society from the top down, is by having a unified face and then sort of putting it out there in this package deal. You either take the package or you reject it. There is no in between, right? And so we just end up taking the package because we don't know that it's a package, you know?
Right. It's not sold as a package.
Right.
Was there anything?
Well, this has been a.
I was going to say, was there anything else you wanted to talk about before we wrap it up? I just thought it was important.
I think we're good.
Yeah, I think that was pretty
nice.
You got anything, JJ?
No, I appreciate it. It's a great conversation. I enjoy talking about these warring and secret societies. I think I mentioned it in a recent podcast Nick and I did on the Nuwaba Nation, where a countercultural figure from the 1960s named Ishmael Reed. He started a countercultural newspaper there in the East Village. It's pretty popular during that time. He commented one of his famous quotes that I enjoy is history is the story between dueling or refuting secret societies. And I think I just paraphrased the quote, but it's essentially that's what he says. Yeah. And I think looking at the War of 1812 is no different than looking at some of these stuff today. And as far as these feuding secret societies and feuds within the secret society, because again, I think that a lot of that goes on within the Society of Cincinnati, repackaged out with it, whatever the outcome is, and then sold to the public as, you know, this is the way it is, deal with it kind of deal. And, you know, I would agree that most people don't agree with those concepts, because it's not what we're sold as what America is. Despite, right. I think some of the, I do believe that there is a contingent within like the Society of Cincinnati that is, has a genuine focus of liberty. And I think George Washington was probably one of those people. However, you know, I guess it depends on what your version and idea of liberty is, and whether or not that liberty conflicts with someone else's liberty. And, you know, so there's a lot of that stuff that goes on. But I think generally speaking, there is two forces. There's the, you know, pro-liberty and anti-liberty kind of force within, specifically within the, within, I think, a lot of secret societies, but within the Society of Cincinnati specifically. And, you know, I do think their goddess worship of these war goddesses and hunting goddesses are indicative of some of the behaviors of the society with regards to the warlike mindset. I mean, famously in recent years, John McCain has gotten the nickname of, what was his nickname? Not John McCain. The eye patch fella that's commonly referred to as
Eye
Patch McCain, because he's Dan Crenshaw, because he's so dead set on war. And that was something John McCain was so dead set on war. And, you know, John McCain just happens to be a hereditary member of the Society of Cincinnati. So
maybe before we leave, I can get into this a little bit. Hold on one second. All right. So I think this book right here, Virgil's Georgics, is the basis for the ideas behind the Society of the Cincinnati. So Virgil was a poet in the Roman period, right? I believe it was around 100 AD, right? But he talks specifically about how everything is toil. All things are toil, and you have to continually keep things in a state of work so that you can manage things better. It has to be moving. It has to be in motion. It has to have a yoke on it. You have to yoke the ox. We would be the ox, right? And so he talks about the Bugonia ritual in this, which is where they would take a bull inside of a shed and then kill it. Wait, you know, I think it's a week. And then bees would come out of the bull carcass, and then you would harvest the bees for honey, right? And so it's that constant state of death, rebirth, and renewal that they were talking about. Now, the Society of the Cincinnati uses that same principle when applied to the general public. You have to have a war to keep everybody on the same page, everybody working in the same direction. You have to use the outside threat to get people to do things they wouldn't normally do. right? And so this is one of the reasons why they would continually have these wars at least once every 10 years as part of a schedule to keep people on the same page. So really, war is a human sacrifice ritual that must be done so that they can continually maintain their authority and their power. So what we see is these, you know, random threats in the Middle East are really a part of a wider agenda on a domestic level than it is on an international level. They're trying to keep us in the same bandwagon, trying to keep us moving forward. And, you know, Virgil, he's talking about life on the farm. We're an agrarian. We started out as an agrarian society. So all of them had known about these agrarian principles in Virgil, and they sort of applied that to the wider nation as sort of like we're just animals living on their farm, right?
No, that's, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, speaking of farmers, Cincinnatus was a farmer, so
you know, that's the point.
He would have adhered to these agrarian principles as well.
Right. So Cincinnatus was before Virgil, and I believe I haven't read all the way through it,
but a few hundred years,
Right. I think Virgil might talk about that, but that's definitely a big link. Really? If you read Virgil, you're going to see a lot of different links with the society. They use the same vernacular and a lot of that stuff. So
interesting.
Oh, wow. Nice. Okay. Well, thank you guys very much. That was a great episode.
Oh, one more thing.
Go for it.
A preview coming up. So I contacted my father about this whole Society of the Cincinnati thing, and he has a contact within the Library of Congress who can probably digitize Adanus Burke's letters to George Washington concerning the Society of the Cincinnati, which would be the first time it's ever been digitized. I found, you know, really, really low quality versions of it in terms of like pictures, JPEGs, but it's completely unreadable. So I'm hoping that his connection within the Library of Congress can actually digitize this in a readable way so that we can actually have what Adanus Burke, the guy who, you know, first stood up against the society back then, we can know what he had to say, because I guarantee it's going to be very prescient as to what situation we find ourselves in today.
Well, that'd be interesting. And let me know if you need any help with that, because I live not far from D.C. right now. So I've been in the Library of Congress looking at some of the old records before, in years past. That's how I discovered the Society's interest in the mounds, because a lot of their surveys were in the Library of Congress. Those are some of the earliest records in our country.
Nice. Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm looking forward to that. I hope that works out. That'll be fun. That'll be interesting for sure. Yes. So fingers crossed that works out, and then there'll maybe be a part three. So
nice.
Yes. Thank you both. And JJ Vance even mentioned something about the Nubian Nation. Yeah, we do have that coming out eventually. And there will be a part two. I do need to get in touch with you, JJ, to schedule another part.
Oh, for sure.
I do think I may actually even, believe it or not, go out there and try to get some film of this place, because it is still open, the one in Brooklyn.
I went to its website.
I went to its website, and it still puts that dude's face on it.
The convicted kid diddler, huh?
His face still shows up. So I want to see, what I really want to see is if the bookstore is open. And if it is, I want to see what kind of fucking books they're pushing in through there. You know,
that'd be awesome.
Yeah. But I definitely have to go down there and then try to schedule part two with you. But
let me know if you're going to do that. I might shoot up and accompany such a mission, if you're going to go check that place out.
Yeah, for sure. I'll let you guys real quick before we end it. Just plug yourselves again. Headless, we'll start with you.
All right. You can find me on X. Just look up The Headless Giant. And you can also find my podcast on Spotify.
Awesome. Thank you very much. And his links are in the bottom. And JJ, plug your stuff real quick.
JJ Vance, host of Operation GCD. Great conversation here today with you, Nick, and Headless both. Enjoyed the conversation. Appreciate the invite. And I'm definitely going to check out this Futures Ancient series you got. That sounds interesting there, Headless.
Awesome. Thank you.
Great stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Great stuff, and I really had a good time. Thank you both. And that is the end of another Occult Rejects. And until the next one, everybody be well. Later.
Well, that's it. That's the show here, folks. So the next time you're out on the town, visiting your local watering holes, or perhaps just meandering around, and you hear the unmistakable sounds of metal clanking, and you spot signs of a disturbance, well, check your six. Look in that garbage can, because you never can tell. The GCDs may be loose in your town.